let's actually talk about how we're going to do this episode, because you said you want it to be an hour long.
Haha, yeah.
It will be an hour long.
We can try.
Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a once formerly, now possibly, monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction, books, reviews, and no idle gossip, because we want to keep this under an hour. Hello, yeah. My name is Ian Mond, and alongside me in the virtual world, her home, wherever that is Kirsten McDermott.
Hi, I'm in Ballarat. You know I'm in Ballarat.
Yeah, but I wasn't. I stumbled there because I wasn't sure whether I should say where you actually live.
Well, it's a small town, but it's a big enough town that people aren't just going to come to Ballarat and say, "Hey, where's Kirsten McDermott?" And everyone can tell them.
Okay, that's true. Good. So we're back.
We're back again.
Yes. Now, of the quarantine edition episode we did, we got very little feedback and basically no love. So really,
we got love. Did you not? You don't get the Gmails.
Why would you not send me the Gmails?
We got one.
That's why.
No. No, I'm like, okay, just stop, because it's not the only one we got, thank you. But no, we got a direct email on the Gmail account, which I thought went to you.
I turned it off, like, well, you know, 3 years ago.
Right. Okay, right. Well, we got a lovely email from Max, who said, please, please, please keep going. And he was so happy to see the latest episode pop up. And we got a few comments on Patreon to the same effect, and some comments on Facebook, actually, on my post. And I don't know about Twitter, because I've not been on Twitter for quite some time. Because
there was a couple of comments on Twitter. But frankly, if you're not writing to me personally, you know, via snail mail, talking your adoration for the work we do, I'm not sure I really take it in.
So anyway, thank you to the lovely people who did comment, even though in Ian's world it was radio silence, apparently. we are back. We are back, and we will be back every month until, I guess, I get tired again.
Which, yes.
Considering I'm starting at a baseline of pretty fucking exhausted, let's just see.
And this is the new normal. It's not just COVID. Post-COVID, we're probably going to do it this way as well. No. Because it took me how long to get to your place?
We live 100 kilometres apart, so.
Yeah.
This is probably, and as I was saying to Ian before we started recording, we will we'll tweak with the tech and see if we can get the audio quality a little bit better as we go along. But for now, this is us, and you're hearing me very nicely because I have all the gear, and you're hearing Ian over the phone.
So, in the intent of keeping this to less than an hour, we're going to get straight into it.
So, Ian, what are we doing this month?
We're doing Skin by Kathy Koja. And we're doing The Minotaur Takes a Cigarette Break by Stephen Sherrill. Why did we choose those two books as our very first comeback podcast books, Kirsten?
Well, it was my idea, and I thought it would be quite interesting to choose two books that we remembered reading at least about 15 years ago and really loving, and then haven't read since. So it would be really interesting to go back and reread them now, 15 or more years later, and see if we still really loved the books or we thought about them in a different way. And also it's a bit of an escape, because we still will probably be giving spoilers on this episode, but these books are very old, so I don't feel bad about that. And from now on, we'll be doing the usual thing of telling you at the end of every episode what we're talking about next month, so you can read those books in advance if you like, and not be spoiled, as it were. But this month there'll be spoilers, and, you know, to be honest, these books are quite old, so not an issue really.
Yeah, so Skin is 1993 when it came out in hardcover, so that's 27 years old. Can you believe
that,
Kirsten?
I did not realise it was that old.
I was 19 when I read it.
I didn't read it when it first came out, but it was still in the 90s when I read it, so probably maybe 2 or 3 years after it came out.
Yes, and The Minotaur Takes a Cigarette Break came out originally in 2000. Though it's got a weird publishing history, but yeah, it is 20 years old.
Yeah.
So, yeah, these are not new books.
But both
are available via the Kindle machine.
They are. So they're available via e-versions if you
Skin got republished. It's been republished probably multiple times, but it got
Skin has just got republished, like just late last year or early this year, actually. So it's available in a very nice new hard copy edition if you like that sort of thing. And spoiler, I still love this book.
Spoiler, my views have changed about the book, which I'll go into in more detail.
So before we go into the book...
Let's talk about it. Let's go do it.
And before we talk about how we felt about the book, Ian, you're going to read a blurb.
Yes.
Go for it.
So we're going to start with Skin.
Yep, we are.
And this is the blurb to Skin from the original hardcover. So as a sculptor of metal, Tess is consumed with the perfection of welds, the drip of liquid metal addicted to the burn. Her solitary existence ends when she meets Bibi. A self-proclaimed guerrilla performance artist, Bibi pushes her body to the utmost in her dancing, sculpting it into a finely tuned machine. But the limits of her body frustrate her. With Tess, she creates a performance art of mobile, blade-like sculptures and human dance that become increasingly violent and dangerous. Still, this is not enough for Bibi. Her desire to grow and transform leads her to body piercing, then to ritual cuttings and scarrings, and further. Though Tess breaks their partnership, she cannot stop Bibi's dark exploration of the limits of her body. Her search is self-destructive, all-encompassing, unstoppable.
I guess our first point of difference is that I refer to her as Bibi. I have the long I.
Okay, yeah, it's probably his Bibi. It's not like Bibi. Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister.
Yeah. No, it's interesting though. Anyway, so as I said, when I first read this book, I adored it, and I was trying to think. And I honestly do not remember if Skin was the. I think Skin was the first Kathy Koja book I read, but I can't swear to that anymore. It may have been The Cipher, which was her debut novel, but I do think that I read Skin first and then went back and got The Cipher and Bad Brains. But certainly it was either the first or second of her novels, and Kathy Koja is a huge influence on my own writing. And this book, I absolutely adored it when I first read it, and I still really, really love it. I look at it a bit differently now, but I just absolutely loved it, and Koja's writing was very different and still is actually different to a lot of the writing that you see in the horror genre. And her books, beginning with The Cipher, were part of a new Del Abyss horror line and of sort of different types of horror, I guess. Koja's work is and remains absolutely amazing. So I just adored this book, and I read it at least twice at the time. I read it and then really soon afterwards, probably not back to back, but probably after reading another one of hers, I went back and read Skin again. And I absolutely loved it. You, Ian, I know had a different response the first time you read it.
So like you, I was a fan of the Del Abyss range. I read nearly all the Del Abyss books when they came out. So I started with The Cipher. That was the first taste of Kathy Koja, and I hated it. I then read Bad Brains, and I hated that. And I read Skin, and I hated Skin as well.
I'm amazed you stuck with her for three books.
I was 19. In fact, I was when Del Abyss first came out, I was 17, and this was the new edge of horror. So, you had Brad Hodge and Ron Dee and a bunch of other authors who Jessica Amanda Samuelson. You've got a whole bunch of authors in that line that were considered to be the Young Turks of horror. And I just wanted to be up to date. I wanted to know what, you know, well, I was 17, frankly. I didn't really think that way. I just wanted to read splatterpunk, I'll be honest. And the covers always were great for the Del Abyss line.
Yep.
And Cipher has a really great idea behind it. I think it's a guy who has a black hole in his cupboard.
Yeah, strange cosmic thing.
I was too young and too closeted and too privileged, and I use that in all its senses, to really understand what Koja was doing in 1991 with The Cipher and Bad Brains and Skin, which is very much while they're not novels necessarily about class per se, they're not exactly about rich middle class people. They're people who are constantly trying to make ends meet. I mean, that's one of the key threads that runs through Skin, how Tess is is constantly, struggling to make any money at all.
yep.
from what she does. And that's and Cypher really has that, and I'm going to use the word, so don't yell at me, Kirsten, has that grungy effect.
No, you can use it. These books came out in the 90s. You can totally say grunge.
Yeah, because they are. That's they have that aspect to them. And, you know, that sort of blue-collar, yeah.
Well, it's interesting. Like you say blue-collar, and I know that's like in Australia, that's definitely the, I guess, a touch word for that particular socioeconomic class. But it's not blue-collar at all, though, really, because all of – and I think of her first four books from Cypher, Bad Brain Skin and then Strange Angels as like her, I guess, her art punk books. And because all of the main characters in those books are struggling artists of some kind. In Cypher, the guy is a poet, or I think a poet, at least a writer, but I think a poet who is having trouble. And in Bad Brains, the protagonist is a painter. In Skin, obviously, we have sculptors and dancers and various different types of art practitioners. And in Strange Angels, again, the protagonist is a struggling painter. And usually the struggle is... Skin is kind of the exception, actually, because Tess is not struggling with her art. She's struggling with money and with relationships and so on, but she's a good practitioner of her art and she's productive.
But not recognised.
Not recognised, but she's productive, whereas the other three protagonists in those other three of Kathy Coger's first four books are having a struggle with their art practice. They're blocked, they're jaded, they don't know, they can't practice, and that becomes a key around the plot of those books, whereas Skin is not that. So it's interesting, but these little collection of, yeah, I kind of think about them as I guess art punk or art grunge perhaps.
I didn't appreciate that back in the day. Mm. Nor did I appreciate Coger's writing style, which
I can imagine.
Yes, I can see the influences in your writing style, Kirsten. I couldn't, the fragmented sentences, the weird rhythm, the way she uses metaphor and simile, my brain just couldn't cope. So, you know, you pick up the Cypher and you read, you know it's about a guy who's essentially got a black hole in his closet, and mm-hmm. you think it's going to be that sort of novel, and it's this weird, it's a weird book, but it's also got this weird prose, and you go, I don't know what this, I can't deal with this. And, you know, I struggled. And yeah. with Skin, I know I bounced, I remember I bounced off it a few times, and I only gave it 2 stars on Goodreads, which is still there if you go and check.
For shame, for shame. Well, I mean, look, you're not the only one. I mean, in preparing for this, I went back and just because I know it was a really old book, and it was interesting to see.
Did you read the Publisher Weekly review?
Yeah, I did. So there were very few reviews, contemporary reviews, as you can imagine. There were some people who'd read it like since and were doing sort of like, you know, a retrospective or whatever. But there were two at the time, one that I found, one Publishers Weekly, which did not like the book, and one from Kirkus Reviews, which also did not really like the book.
In fact, the Kirkus one takes the piss.
It really does. I'm not a fan of Kirkus Reviews generally, but it was interesting because I wanted to, I guess, I'm going to pull a line from each of those, which I think does represent a certain, reception of Coger's work and writers who do similar stylistic turns. Like a lot of Caitlin Kiernan's, the first half, I guess, of her career, very, very much in a similar vein in terms of fragmented sentences and highly stylistic writing. And she has, like, her style has obviously changed over her career, and she's writes a little bit differently in recent years. But certainly her first novels and short fiction did use, non-standard structures in certain respects in the actual mechanics of her writing and lots of portmanteaus and things like that. But yeah, so I'm gonna the pull quote from the Kirkus review that I had talks about Coger at times weld scrap sentences into burrows like cut up paragraphs that mimic her heroine's sculpture, which can be hard on the reader. And the Publisher's Weekly review says that Coger has, and this is Yeah, this is from a review of Skin. So Koja has a considerable talent for evoking atmosphere, but her style, an obscurantist mix of stark minimalism and florid gush, further distances the characters from the reader and hampers the novel's already minimal movement. And I guess that is, it would be a not uncommon response to Koja's style. It's still not a common style, right? I think of her work as it's sort of impressionistic and even expressionistic if you think about visual arts. And I don't think you're meant to. I don't think you're meant to deliberately and consciously pass 100% of her prose as you read it. Like, as you mentioned before, there is a rhythm and a texture to her sentences, and she uses words not just for their semantic meaning but for the sound of the word and the texture of the word. It's one of the great things about the English language is we have, you know, multiple synonyms for a similar meaning. But Koja even uses things that actually don't possibly make literal sense if you really decode some of the sentences. But the sound of those words, the connotations they evoke. She's a very connotative writer, more than a literal writer, I think. And you're not reading it this second time, and you know, having grown as a writer myself and being a lot more conscious about what you do with words as a writer. I was very aware that most of the time I was having to let a lot of the prose not wash over me, but it was more me swimming through it and not trying to catch every wave and not trying to catch every movement of the water, but just to be in the prose and feel what that was creating around me. That probably makes very little sense. But
no, I understand. It's about what I experienced as I read it. I do understand that.
Yeah.
It's a book that deliberately doesn't allow you to just zip through it. You can't rush through this novel. But it has its own rhythm. And when she describes the dance scenes early on in the novel, it's extraordinary. It's almost mythical in her descriptions. And she gets into look, I know nothing about dance or sculpture or anything like that, but she gets into this rhythm with the prose that just brings it alive.
It does,
And you don't necessarily know what's going on, you know, I couldn't not entirely imagine how the dances and her sculptures were all meshing together in the performances, but I got the feel for it. I understood, and as an audience, if I was an audience member, I could, you know, especially that the smoke filling the warehouse and people choking, but yet still loving it because that's part of the whole thing,
and
the aesthetic of it.
And I think that is the genius and the magnificence of her prose work is that you couldn't, anyone who read those scenes, and they go on for pages, and they're not detailed, but they're quite I guess explicit in what they're describing, and no one who read them could sit down and write down what this particular performance looked like. Everyone's description of it, if you ask them, okay, so what are the dancers doing at any particular point, and what does it actually look like? Everyone's would be quite different. But what she's doing with the prose is basically those particular details don't actually matter. They don't matter. What matters is the feeling of this performance and how an audience member at these strange, violent, sometimes threatening performances would actually feel. And as you said, she brings a lot of sensory description into it, so sounds and smells and tastes and so on, as well as what you might actually be seeing or hearing. She's an incredibly sensory writer, always is with her work.
I love this line, which is early on in the novel, just saying, an empty bag against her shoulder like a flopping flap of skin, skirting the back of a moving bus, halo of fume, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that skirt, that flap of skin, flopping flap of skin. And later on in the book there's this – I mean, look, I could go on these sorts of things, because I'm pretty sure you're going to quote a bunch –
I haven't pulled out a lot of quotes because I think the other problem is with Koja's writing.
Can I just do this one?
Yeah,
The frisky gush of sparks. I mean, that's genius.
It is. And the thing is with a lot of her work, it doesn't actually lend itself to pull quotes. In fact, you can pull things out of her work that actually may sound a bit trite or a bit weird, but it's all in context. You need, like, her prose. The thing about Coach's work is her prose builds on itself. So everything is so tightly linked together. It's like weaving a blanket, and if you just pull a thread out and say, hey, look at this great thread, that thread makes
context,
no sense.
Out of context, it just feels like overwrought purple writing. And yet you've got brilliant things like she vomits at one point. In fact, I think she vomits a few times. And it's described as a purling wretch.
Yeah. Like her work, like, honestly, like, I
think no one has ever put the word purling and wretch together ever. This is the first and only time, I'd say.
She is one of my absolute favourite writers from many points of view, but from a stylistic point of view, she's unparalleled. Really, her writing is quite magnificent, and it is an impressionistic style. I think it's not going to be. A lot of readers are going to bounce off it, like the Publishers Weekly folks who felt her writing distanced the characters from the readers, whereas for me, I felt her writing pulled us so intimately close to the characters you couldn't escape from them. And in this. Like in this novel, this is a third person direct point of view, and you're just with Tess the whole way. And you are there inside her head, inside her skin. And I find it an incredibly intimate style of writing. But obviously, for other readers, it is a prose that feels distancing and feels that you can't connect to it. So
here's a question for you. Here's a question. Mm-hmm. Why Tess, not Bibi? As the third person direct perspective, why pick Tess? Given it's the if you look at the who goes through the transformation,
Tess goes
literal,
through
the literal transformation as distinct from
I think Bibi is the cipher in this. We don't really get a good grasp until close to the end what exactly Bibi is pursuing, and her radical. And by the end, very extreme body modification practice is something that I think a lot of readers, unless you're in that culture, would find difficult to, I guess, understand beyond a certain point.
Well, Publishers Weekly certainly didn't understand it, because I'm sure they're the one who said this is for a niche audience.
Yeah.
And also made the point that there was no explanation as to why this woman is interested in...
Yeah, and look, I found the explanation was, by the end, the explanation was incredibly horrifically clear.
Yeah.
But the fact that we didn't get the explanation until the end is part of what kept it. Because Tess doesn't know. Tess doesn't really want to understand. It's something that scares her about Bibi, and she really doesn't. Tess is a master at just excluding anything she doesn't want to know about. She's just really, really good at it. Like her whole relationship with Michael, I hated him so much. And because the second, like reading it again years later, I didn't remember a lot of the plot points, and I'd gotten some plot points mixed up. But I did remember basically his role in the novel, which was as this key manipulator and failed artist, aborted artist. Like he's never been able to really practice art, and he's so intensely jealous of those who can, and he's made his, I guess, what he feels as an artistic practice, the manipulation of others, which is kind of cool from when you think about how it operates in the book. But Tess's whole relationship with him is an exercise in compartmentalization and dismissing the bits that she doesn't care about. Like he goes away and does things, and she sometimes begins to wonder what he's doing, and then says, "I don't really care," and goes back to her art. She's very, very good at just cutting off her attention.
But her friends who live below her and who look at her as a mentor, Nikki and Jerome, I think, I'm trying to remember the names.
But anyway,
they warn her multiple times.
Yeah.
They know what's going on. You're right, but she still compartmentalizes.
Well, I don't think they don't really know what's going on with Michael. I think Raylene, at the very beginning, there's this beautiful line that you don't pick up until, I think, on a reread, where Raylene, who's one of the dancers in the original troupe, says to Bibi and Tess, you know, Michael's the one to watch out for. Michael's the real danger. And they kind of laugh it off, because at the time there's all this interpersonal dispute and fractiousness in the group, and Michael's the only one who seems like he's nice and not making trouble and trying to build bridges and trying to be the person who, you know, is the mediator and reconciler of things. And so the idea that he's the one who might be be the problem is a bit ridiculous. But of course, Raylene, like way, way back at the beginning, was absolutely right about him, and she was the first one who saw that somehow. And it's a beautiful little throwaway scene. It's just when you reread it, knowing who Michael is, it's like, oh my God, someone saw that so early. And the warning wasn't heeded. So, but Raylene gets out of this cleanly. So it's nice.
So the book is dealing with a culture that has no resonance for me. I have no interest in, but I'm still interested.
So the body modification or the art?
Yeah. Well, the sculpting is not my thing, but yeah, I can appreciate sculpting. Yeah. And I also, I mean, again, with Koja, the descriptions of the sculptures are very impressionistic as well. Although the one with the tunnel with the eyes, that sticks out. She starts building these boxes, and the boxes have things within them, and one of them is a tunnel with all these little eyes indented into it. And yeah, that's pretty clear and frightful. The body modification thing, I don't understand. I accept the fact that that's my own limitation, not the book's. And so I'm not taking the Publisher Weekly view of, oh, it's a niche thing, so therefore what's the point?
Because this is what I was saying. Like, it's not
But I am interested to know how – because ultimately the book does take a view, it seems to me anyway, that body – that well, if any obsession is bad, and if you go too far with these sorts of body modification –
that's the view. And that's the view with the art. I mean, that's, you know, like – The comment he's make about Tess's practice as well, the fact that she gets her insularity and her isolation becomes so extreme.
Tess hates the modification from the very beginning, just the cutting.
Yeah.
The basic, which Linda Joy does. She hates that.
Yeah. So she's viscerally, she's viscerally affected by it. And look, to be honest, it's common, right? You know, you see someone cut themselves, or you know, it's something that you generally cringe from. We don't like seeing pain. You know, most of us don't like feeling pain or seeing pain in others. So it is an immediate visceral response, and that remains Tessa's response. Like she, as I said, if she does not like something, she just blocks it out. So as much as Bibi in the beginning is wanting her to understand, Tess doesn't want to understand, and that's the stance she takes, and she does not move from that. She does not want to understand, and it's, you know, as much as Bibi is very forceful, and you know, it's one thing for Bibi to want to do to her own body what she desires. She's also, when Tess and her are together, first as a artistic partnership, and then later as lovers, she's also constantly pushing at Tess to get something done to Tess's own body, and that's the line that Bibi can't seem to see needs to be there. Even if Tess is accepting of what she's doing, she doesn't have a right to tell Tess that you have to get a piercing or you have to get a cutting in order to understand me. But by the same token, Tess just refuses to understand at all. She just doesn't want any part of it. So it's little wonder their relationship just implodes. Because, you know, like in terms of the relationship, I think it's really easy because we're sitting in Tessa's point of view. And I do remember reading this at the time and thinking Bibi was just awful, like just awful, like a horrible, horrible person. And reading it later, I guess much older, you see that Tess is as much responsible for the breakdown in that relationship as Bibi, because Tess just refuses to understand. Like, Bibi's right. There's a line where she says to Tess, you know, this is really important to me, and you just refuse to even consider my point of view. And she's absolutely right. And you can't be in a relationship with someone, either in, you know, an artistic collaboration or a romantic relationship or a friendship, if you just refuse to even try to understand the other person's perspective. And this, on this read, that came through very clear to me. I just wanted to shake Tess sometimes, and it's like Bibi's, I guess, descent is, you know, like it's not Tess's fault, but there, you know, I don't know, there feels like there's a responsibility there, because Tess was just always, I guess, refusing to allow Bibi that part of herself in their relationship.
So that self-destruction is my problem with the book.
Mm.
I maybe, and I think it's because I'm in my mid-40s, I'm not in the headspace. Okay, so let me explain. So it's not like Kathy Kojo isn't doing anything that people aren't doing right now. So one of the most popular books of the moment, just got turned into a TV series with Hulu, is Sally Rooney's Normal People, which is essentially for all, and I've read it, I've not watched the Hulu series, but it's essentially about a self-destructive relationship where, you know, two people who can clearly love each other, but they just can't find that common ground and they keep bouncing off each other. And it doesn't work well for really either of them. And so it's not like, you know, and I love that book. So it's not like I'm against books that have relationships where the two partners are both leading, heading towards and it's clear from the outset, this is not going to end well.
No.
Okay? It's all going to end in tears. My problem with Skin, though, and I'm still trying to figure it out in my own head, is that there is a nihilism to the book that I just can't pass.
There is. And I think that's a really good word.
Especially the last 50 pages. The last 50 pages there's an angst and a nihilism that is very probably 1990s as well, given what was going on in the 1990s. Not that we weren't having pandemics then, but it was, you know, this is the also the period where we have Chuck Palahniuk writing Fight Club and destroying whole cities. There was this whole middle class. There was the economy was doing well for those who were especially in America we're talking here, for those who could make the most of it. The economy was growing beyond. So you had Bush's failure with the economy. Clinton comes in. There's a growth in the economy. So the middle class is growing, and people are being left behind as a result. Mm. And you start to see that friction, that tension in some of the fiction. And look, this is probably a little bit too early when this was published to entirely articulate that. But I can see where that nihilism has that antecedence in what was going on in America at the time. And look, we're seeing it today as well. Don't get me wrong. But I don't know. Maybe it's because I've got two kids and I'm just the way I think. I just couldn't deal with it.
Yeah, I think nihilism is actually a really, really good word to I guess, thematically describe Kojo's first four novels, from Cypher to Strange Angels. And it's a nihilism that is often embedded in her protagonists. And it's something that they often don't recognise about themselves. But it is a really good word, I think, to describe her work and Skin in particular. What I found really interesting about Skin in that sense, as I said, unlike the protagonist of those other three novels, Tess is actually practising her art and practising it well. She's not showing, and most in the last half of... for most of the novel, that's actually her choice. And I think one of the warnings of this novel is it's showing you these sort of two extremes. So you've got the extreme that Bibi takes with her art and the body modification that she sees as her art, and then ultimately as a religion of some kind. And she's taking that to self-destructive and just generally destructive extremes. But I think Tessa's practice as well, her isolation, her insularity, the idea that she is practicing art just for herself, with no interest in anyone else seeing it. And that's fine, but if one of the primary, I guess, motivations and drivers and even value of art its ability to communicate and build connections between people, then what are you doing as an artist if your entire practice is isolated and...
Yeah, that drove me mad. You know? The fact that she doesn't want anyone to see her work.
And that's I think, something that, like, the book is looking at these two extremes, one which is a really showy extreme, but one which is just because, like, what is Tess doing? Tess ends up in...
It's like she has a tantrum, a very, very aloof tantrum, but one where she tried to sell a piece of art early in the book. It gets rejected. Well, no one buys it. And she decides at that point, well, fuck yous all. None of you appreciate what I do.
Well, no, because I disagree with you there, because I think what the chain is, what the trigger is Paul's death. So she has that showing, and yes, the work not selling actually comes in the middle of her surgeon's thing, because the show's just there, right? What happens is she has that show. Bibi finds her and they put the surgeons together and start doing these massive performances. And Tess is making work for public exhibition there. She's making work for these shows. What changes is Paul's death.
Fair enough.
Then she closes down.
Yeah, fair enough.
And nothing else she does from that point, from when Paul is killed in the middle of the show and the surgeons end, nothing she does from that point. It's almost as though she blames – well, she does. She blames herself in part, and she blames her art for the death of Paul, and for the, I guess, the extremes to which that troupe began to go. And so it's almost as though she's decided, without really consciously ever thinking it even to herself, let alone saying it to anyone, that her art is dangerous and therefore no one gets to see it but herself. It's like that's the point at which she closes down. And I think that's, you know, the book is articulating the fact that is as bad for an artist and for a human being as the extremes that Beebe is taking. So it's both ends of that. Is this extreme public, blood and violence and self-destruction. But then it's this other one. It's this self-destruction via isolation and insulation and refusing to connect with people in any meaningful way. So it is absolutely nihilistic. Like there's no redemption for anyone in this book.
That's why I wouldn't be giving this 5 stars on Goodreads, but I'd probably give it, if you could do 3.5, that's what I'd probably end up. Not that we try and quantify this for each book. I'm just saying that because I had already read it, it would definitely go up because the writing is extraordinary. Unless you have anything more to say, this is going to be the worst segue ever.
No, I think that's
I feel like
it.
Now I'm in one of those Zoom meetings at work. Unless you have anything more to say on this
what
matter.
What else is on the agenda? Moving forward, we should now talk about – yes, no, I have not. I guess I'll sum up my reading experiences of I remember at the time first reading it that I was completely on Tessa's side and the whole, artist doing great work and no one understanding was – completely my jam, and now it's just like, oh, for fuck's sake, Tess. Like, I was as frustrated and impatient with her, I think, as I was with Beebe. I mean, I understood them both a lot more, and I think I was much more sympathetic to Beebe this time and more understanding of Tess's limitations and issues as well.
Not that I don't want to give you the last word, but just something that occurred to me. Mm-hmm. One thing that's great about Koja is that although it is set 27 years ago, the prose is ageless. You can the fact that no one has mobile phones and all those, anachronisms and that, it's not relevant. The prose and the situations that the characters are going through, you can pick this up in 2020 and just feel that it came out a week ago.
And it's so well grounded in its world, which at the time was just the world, that her world building, her transferal of the world as it was in the mid-90s into this book is so wonderful that even when you're reading it 20, 30 years later, that is the world. So nothing feels wrong. Yes. You don't at any time think, why don't they just ring someone or why don't they just go on the internet? Because that's not the world then, and it's certainly not the world for her characters at the time either. And it just feels so complete and so utterly representative of this particular place and time that it's a joy to read, actually. It's fabulous.
A place where everyone seems to enjoy drinking really terrible coffee. Did you notice how many times she's given really bad coffee?
Well, they are in America.
Also, crap segue. Let's talk about the Minotaur takes a cigarette break.
Yes, and this is not one I had read back in the day. I had not even heard of this book or this author when you recommended it a month ago. So, yes.
I shall read the blurb again, which is one of those blurbs that also tells you what the I like your copy. It's one of those blurbs that tells you what the themes of the book is. Which I'm half and half about. Anyway, The Minotaur Takes a Cigarette Break by Stephen Sherrill. In this debut novel, Stephen Sherrill follows the Minotaur, a mythological creature with the body of a man and the head of a bull, through 2 weeks of his life as a cook at a steakhouse in the contemporary American South. Once a devourer of virgins and lads, time and circumstances have diminished his power considerably. Through the Minotaur's experience, Sherrill spotlights the alienation and loneliness that are part of our society. During the two-week period, we follow the Minotaur. We meet memorable characters along the way, from his co-workers at the restaurant to his neighbours at the trailer park. Sherrill also manages to make mundane doings, kitchen work, car repair, personal grooming, interesting and even exciting. Woohoo! By the end of the novel, the reader is pulling for the Minotaur to find the brief moment of happiness that he has sought for so many centuries.
Oh my God, that is the worst. I would never have read that. That is the worst blurb ever. And it's
this
different.
This is common though. You will find, this is why I've stopped reading blurbs. This is common. This sort of blurb now.
I think it might be common in literary fiction. I don't think it's common.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is common in literary fiction. The blurbs that both tell you what actually happens throughout the whole
thing. And how
novel.
You're meant to feel about it. That's gross.
Yes, and how you're meant to feel about it.
And it's not, correct. Well, here's interesting, because the copy I have, I just bought on eBay, because I found a really cheap, and it's the original paperbacks that was published in 2000, and it's not the blurb that's on this book. Let me read you what's on this book. 5,000 years on, and the Minotaur, or M as he's known to his colleagues, is working as a line chef at Grubb's Rib in the American Deep South, keeping to himself, keeping his horns down, trying in vain to put his past behind him. Inarticulate, socially inept, tolerated at best by those around him, he's been transformed over the centuries from a monster with an appetite for human flesh to a broken creature with very human needs. But during a two-week period, the delicate balance tips, and M finds his life dissolving into chaos while he simultaneously awakens to the possibilities of happiness and love. And then there is a little bit of a line about, you know, the Minotaur takes a cigarette break, is an effortless blend of the mundane and the mythic, a quirky, unforgettable first novel that is compassionate, poetic, funny, poignant and wise, blah, 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 blah. But, oh, and also, above all, it serves as a reminder of fiction's ability to change the way we see the world and ourselves. But does it, though? Anyway, but it's a much better blurb in terms of just giving you an idea of what the novel's like rather than telling here's exactly what happens and here's how you're meant to feel about it and here's how you should sum up at the end. It's like, why would I read that novel? You've now told me, A, what the novel's about, how I should feel and what my conclusion is that I should draw. I'm done here. I'm done. I don't even need to read it. Thank you for saving me $29.95. Yeah, that's
so true.
It's a terrible blurb.
That's why we're going to start reading blurbs out, just to compare and contrast. So the publication history of this book, it actually was originally published in 2000 by John F. Blair Publisher, which is a small, from what I understand, not that I've done any research, North Carolina publisher.
The one I have is, by the way, is a Canongate. It's a UK edition.
Yes. So let me explain to you, Kirsten, what happened. So that was in May of 2000, and it then got picked up by Canongate, an American publisher, I can't remember who, although I could check Goodreads to find out, later that year. Okay, so it was both published by a small press and then picked up by a larger press in the same year and exploded. So if you go to Goodreads, you'll find that there's 3,330 ratings for this book. It's a cult classic. It's known as a cult classic. It's a book that, in fact, Neil Gaiman picked up to spearhead his audiobook line that he has, mm-hmm. which I didn't even know Neil Gaiman had an audiobook line, but apparently he does.
It would lend itself very well to an audiobook, just in the terms of the style in which it's written. It would be a good – like, I don't think you could do – You could do Skinner as an audiobook. It would be difficult, but I think that the prose in this book would lend itself very well to being read aloud. Yes, I think
the prose is very clean. The prose is very clean and great. Anyway, before we get to the prose, so I suppose so Stephen Sherrill himself is a poet. Went to the Iowa, did an MFA in poetry in the Iowa Writers Workshop. I'm getting all this from his blurb, etc. This book was huge. I know you've not heard of it, but at the time it was big. And I actually picked it up, I'm pretty sure, in 2003 when it was republished, because it's been republished multiple times. Mm-hmm. He's written four novels since then, including a sequel to this book.
Yeah, I thought there was a sequel out there.
Yes. The sequel came out 2 years ago. I didn't even know it had come out.
Oh, right.
Because that's what sometimes happens with authors that have massive first books. The sophomore effort and then from that point on don't get the same The part of the problem is for Stephen Sherrill is that his second book came out 4 years later. So whatever momentum had happened with his first novel, it may have lost something. So by the time of his second novel.
Yeah, but that's not such a big gap for literary fiction authors.
Fair enough. Well,
it is for genre authors, but it's not for lit fic.
His second novel, Visits from the Drowned Girl, maybe just wasn't very good, because I've not read it. I didn't even know it existed. You compare the two novels in terms of Goodreads ratings, it's not even in the same universe. And then it doesn't get much better for Stephen Sherrill from that point on. This is very depressing for Stephen Sherrill. I don't really need to make a point, but it's just that he has his first book certainly captured people's imaginations, less so his follow-up novels. Even The Minotaur Takes His Own Sweet Time hasn't probably garnered that much, but
Do you think The Minotaur was a book of its time, and coming back to it 20 years later or 18 years later, it's missed that time now?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, look, it's interesting to read. Okay, it's Goodread comments from people saying basically, yeah, maybe you should have just left it with the first book, and yeah, but anyway,
yeah.
I love this novel. Let me put it another way. I loved this novel. When I reread it, I still loved it, but I didn't remember the ending. And it's the ending that slightly upset me.
Slightly.
Yeah. Slightly is underplaying it. If you could excise the last 15 to 20 pages, I'd say this would still be a perfect novel and we'd get 5 stars. And we'll talk more about the ending.
Mm-hmm. We will. So spoilers, people. The ending
is just something that obviously washed over me when I read the novel back in the day.
I think you were young, so yeah, I can imagine
The connotations of what that ending.
I know exactly what that ending's doing, and I fucking hate it so much.
Yeah.
I hate the whole book because of that ending.
Let's talk about the good first, which is 90% of the novel in my view, and maybe you don't agree, but I think it does a beautiful thing in that it takes this creature from Greek mythology, puts him in a completely mundane setting, and somehow makes it work, in my view. I mean, I just love the Minotaur. I love that everyone sort of just both accepts but doesn't accept. No one treats the Minotaur as, my God, are you a creature from Greek mythology? In fact, there's this one moment late in the book where a father and child see the Minotaur, and the child is scared of it, and the dad, as he's walking out with the child, says, yeah, look, don't worry, when we get home, I'll show you who the Minotaur was, you know, in the mythology books. But mundane.
That's the conceit of the book. So that's your that's your buy-in, as Mary Robinette Cowell would say.
Either works or it doesn't work, and for me it works. For me, some people are either going, oh, my God, that's just stupid, that's a silly idea, you know, people would be screaming from the restaurant that he works at if they saw him there.
Let's face it, Pat, you know, maybe back when, the impression you get is that the mythological creatures have just always been there and sort of adapted throughout society. So this is not really our world. There was no moment where they just popped into being and everyone had their freak out and now they're like, yeah, that's the Minotaur or that's Medusa
That you've had to work through reading between the lines. Mm. Yes, there's a scene where he comes across a person like him.
Mm.
I can't remember. There's a couple of instances like that, but you've got to read that into the book.
Yeah.
It's not explicated. There's nothing where the Minotaur tells us, yes, we've just been accepted within society and this is how it is. It's just the world as presented
the whole,
to us.
But the whole book tells you that. So you just go, okay, this is the buy-in. And he does. Look, I mean, Sherelle does that. He does it really well. Like, he presents that, and because the narrative is accepting of it, and the characters are all accepting of it, the reader is. I mean, this is just the world.
Yeah, but Kirsten, how many books have you read? Contemporary fantasy novels have you read that would make a point of trying to explain why everyone accepts the Minotaur as is, and do a whole back flashback and blah blah blah.
Well,
he doesn't bother with it.
I mean,
the thing is
that everybody accepts his presence. He's in no way accepted by society as the creature that he is. Like, they accept the fact of his existence, but they don't accept
his otherness. Mm. Isn't so much that he's a Minotaur from Greek mythology; it's just that he's different.
But he's different because he's the Minotaur from Greek mythology. I don't think. Here's the thing: because many times throughout the book, I'm reading it, and like I never forgot he's the Minotaur. And in fact, it's very clever making his character designation M. And not giving him a name, because it reminds you of every time you see that M that he is the Minotaur. It's a great letter. The letter itself has horns. It's beautifully coincidental that the Minotaur starts with the letter M. But at several times throughout the book, I did find myself thinking, it's like, well, does he have to be the Minotaur? I mean, he could just be this guy who's got, you know, maybe a speech impediment, or because the Minotaur is, you know, we're told he has a speech impediment by human terms. It skirts very close to making you start to think about bodily mechanics, but we can leave all those aside.
I think it does deal with the bodily mechanics to a degree.
It doesn't. Let's just leave aside the fact the Minotaur can talk with a cow's head.
Okay.
But anyway, but no, so like a lot of the time I was thinking, and I still think you could write the book with almost no difference if the Minotaur wasn't the Minotaur. like it would.
Yeah, but it wouldn't have the same resonance. He's playing on that resonance.
I know he's playing on the resonance. I just felt that he wasn't.
You could say this of any book that uses mythological aspects as metaphor. I mean, that's.
Well, and I think that was the problem. I don't think he played on the resonance enough. I didn't feel. I don't know. He would explicitly, as an author, say, because this is a third person narrative, and I would class it as an omniscient narrative.
Yes.
And he did at time very explicitly say, as the author, you know, the Minotaur feels the drag of centuries on his mind sometimes. And you go, you're telling me that I'm not seeing that. Like I'm not. I don't know. I felt like the author had to tell me stuff too much rather than let me. I mean, maybe I just, you know.
I couldn't disagree. In fact, I found those bits that you're referring to the most poignant stuff, because I think it, again, is a nice juxtaposition of working as a blind chef at Grubbs and at the same time being this ancient creature.
Yeah.
That
and I think
only
we,
vaguely remembers what he did in the past, but remembers enough.
Look, I think when we were shown things, and there's some fabulous scenes in here, and I mean one of the ones that stick with me is when the Minotaur is just channel surfing through a bout of insomnia and comes across the end of a televised bullfight in Spain, and you get to feel that the emotion that he has and his response to that, which is really complex and he doesn't even quite understand it himself, and I from memory in that scene the narrator almost refrains from decoding that for you, but I think he says something about why the Minotaur feels like that. And it's like you don't – he does a well enough job of giving you the sense of the Minotaur and his complexity as this creature and where he's – how he's living and where he's living and why. But it, a lot of the time the narrator just can't resist telling you why or how the Minotaur is feeling that way, and it just, I don't know, as a reader, I feel like you showed me this, I got it, you didn't have to tell me, I kind of got it, so that, I don't know, it's...
So you would have been annoyed by the whole bit around how he wants to sing, and he loves the idea of singing, but he just can't, because it talks to the mechanics of both why he can't sing, but also the deep desire he has for this ability to be able to hold a melody. And to me, that again was quite beautiful and poignant. But you would have argued, "Well, no, that's
look." As a reader,
ramming it down our throat.
As a reader, I am less. In much the same way as Publishers Weekly felt disconnected from Coge's prose, I feel less connected by omniscient narrator more and more these days, because when I'm told something by an omniscient narrator about how a character is feeling, or more particularly why they're feeling that way, it just feels like you've not let me work this out for myself. You've not let me feel this for myself, and I have felt it, and you don't need to, you know, I don't need the validation from the narrator, I guess.
Okay, so
that's a perspective as a reader.
Let me read out a passage, which I loved.
Mm-hmm.
The architecture of the Minotaur's heart is ancient, rough-hewn and many-chambered. His heart is a plodding, laborious thing, built for churning through the millennia. But the blood it pumps, the blood it has pumped for 5,000 years, the blood it will pump for the rest of his life is nearly human blood. It carries with it through his monster's veins the weighty, necessary, terrible stuff of human existence, fear, wonder, hope, wickedness, love. But in the Minotaur's world, it is far easier to kill and devour 7 versions, year after year, their rattling bones rising at his feet. Like a sea of cracked ice, then too, and I didn't highlight the rest of it, but you get the point of the what's going on there. And to me, again, I love that prose.
I mean, that is fine.
Oh, it's, that it's, particular one is good.
No, because he's not really like explaining a, like he's just giving you some, I guess, mythic background. It's more when, and look, I didn't highlight anything in particular on that level, but it's more when he is just really telling you extra things on something he's just shown you, you know. But I mean, as I said, that's more me as a reader these days. I feel much more connected to a book when the narration is not too omniscient and not too, I don't know. I can't really explain it. And no, it's not that right. I hate all omniscient narrations.
That's fine. You don't have to say anymore.
I guess maybe the voice of this book, I just didn't connect with the voice of this book. So therefore,
whereas I absolutely connected.
But what I didn't like, stylistically though, what I really didn't like about this book, and to me this is a flaw of the prose, is it was just so overly detailed in its descriptions. And I think sometimes that
worked. Like the ablutions?
Sometimes it worked, but a lot of the time it didn't. And when it worked, it was working to put you into the Minotaur's, I guess, mind at the time and how he was feeling. And so actually the passages where they describe how he needs to rub the moisturizer into the meeting point between his man self and his bull self, because that skin is like, it's a scar that's never really healed. If I like the idea that there's a scar there, because that's not, from what I remember, that's not the Minotaur's. Like, he was not a created creature. He was born and just happens to be a hybrid. So I'm not, like, from my understanding of the mythology, I don't know why there's a scar, but I like that there's a scar. I like that Cheryl has put this join in this creature's body, and it's quite poignant. And the fact that it has never really healed is lovely. And that, like that scene, for example, and those couple of scenes where he's talking about the Minotaur oiling his, lacquering his horns and needing to care for this body, like that type of detail is good, because it puts you in the physicality of the beast, and it lets you know what he's doing. But the problem for me was that this book is just overly detailed and on almost every turn. And quite a lot of the time for me, it worked against what the narrative at that point was trying to do. And I do have an example. I guess what I would think of an example of, like, where it really didn't work, but this is not the only one for me. So, for example, this is, this is a confrontation between the Minotaur and Josie, who's one of his fellow residents at the caravan park, the trailer park, I think Americans would call it, where he lives.
Yes, the Minotaur lives in a trailer park.
And so he has this confrontation with one of the other residents, and it's you know, well done. And but I'm going to read you this paragraph. So he says, feeling that the danger has passed, the Minotaur stands from his crouch, because it was a physical confrontation. In standing, he bumps the tray of sockets, arranged first according to the size of the drive, then by dimension, metric on one side, standard on the other, divided by the polished ratchets, balanced carelessly on the lid of the closed toolbox. It's like the parenthetical insert he had there about how the tools are arranged serves no purpose to that paragraph, and just slows down this narrative where the Minotaur is feeling threatened and in danger and is you know, like, and that's just one example. It would have.
Whereas I see it as very much in the mode of the way the Minotaur's slow mind works, but also the intricacies.
But the Minotaur of the way his mind. But the works. Minotaur is not seeing those sockets, because the movements
of
that.
It's creating a flavour.
No. But this is omniscient narrative. The narrator is telling you about these sockets, because in the moment, what is happening is, in standing, he bumps the tray of sockets, balanced carelessly on the lid of the closed toolbox. They spill, a brief hailstorm of steel. The squat cylinders scatter in the grass, catching the sun as they roll and tumble. By putting in that, and it is in, it's in, an M dash, by putting in this parenthetical bit about how they're arranged, which in that moment the Minotaur wouldn't see, because he gets up and knocks them. He doesn't see how they're arranged at the moment when he's knocking them down. It just slows down that paragraph, and it's the narrator telling you this. It's not something the Minotaur is seeing at the time or focusing. It's not like he turns and sees and he's distressed and upset and he turns and sees this tray of sockets and he focuses on how they're arranged and how they're looking, and that's something that calms him down or gives him something to focus on apart from his...
Well, he would know how he's... Because they're his sockets, so yeah. He would know how they're arranged.
Absolutely.
Look, I get what you're saying.
But I'm saying that's just one... That's just an example. And I just feel like sometimes the detail worked really well for what that particular scene was doing, and sometimes to me it was like, oh, for fuck's sake, can we just...
I love those flourishes.
Mm.
I especially love them when he's in the kitchen. All the food stuff in this, to me, is wonderful.
Not just the goings on
in the actual kitchen itself, and the byplay between all the cooks and the waitresses, and there's some good stuff and bad stuff, but it's just the way he prepares food and just the whole food preparation stuff is wonderful. And the description of – it starved me, this book,
I liked this book up until the end. Like, I didn't hate it. It was just like it wasn't a book that I loved.
Let's talk about it.
But the ending was something that made me so angry, and now I hate this book so much.
And I should note, before the end, a dog dies, which is a common trope in literary fiction.
I got to say, the dog bit I loved – not the dog dying, but the fact that the dog is not owned by the Minotaur, it's owned by the man who runs the trailer park, and the dog is hit. It's a hit and run by someone. It's not one of the characters in the book who does it. And it's just a hit and run, and this poor dog is killed, and he's just left where he lies. And it's such a complex part of the book, and it goes on because the owner comes home and also just leaves the dog there. And what I loved about this whole sequence is, maybe because it's not about the Minotaur, but Cheryl refrains from ever revealing exactly why the owner of the dog just left the dog there to rot for quite some time and then finally burnt the corpse and let it go. But you know why he did it. But the narrator doesn't feel the need to tell you. And I guess that is sometimes how I felt the Minotaur should have been as well. We shouldn't have been told all the time exactly why he was feeling things, because the story did a good enough job of that. And to his credit, he didn't explain why the Minotaur also left the dog there. And I thought that was fantastic, and I wanted the whole book to be more like that, less explaining about the interiority and more just showing you what's happening, because Cheryl does a really good job of presenting these complex situations and these complex reactions. And that the whole dead dog sequence was, I think, just masterful. But anyway, the ending.
Fair enough. I don't agree with you. But I do agree with you on the ending, clearly, because even though we haven't spoken about it.
So what's the ending?
Essentially, the ending is a culmination. The Minotaur has feelings throughout the book for a waitress called Kelly.
Yeah.
It's set up early on in the novel that Kelly suffers from epilepsy. But she reciprocates those feelings, at least the second they go on out on a date to a golf course, which I found really funny.
She initiates some of the feelings.
There's a big porn drive-in next to the golf course, and they can hear while they're playing golf, they can hear the
mini golf session the mini golf session's fantastic.
Yeah, so the mini golf stuff. And they have a relationship, and then it gets intimate in the last few pages of the novel, but... As that's happening, and it's a big deal for the Minotaur because he hasn't really touched anyone in centuries. Yep. He's had partners before, but usually in his more
rapacious
and salad years.
Yes.
His years where he was eating virgins and lads. So he hasn't really been with anyone. So it's a massive deal, and I think beautifully written at that point. And then she has an epileptic fit while he's doing they're getting extremely intimate. He doesn't know that, at least initially. So, okay, so he doesn't know it, and we can talk about that. He does continue, but then he stops.
But not for long. And as soon as he realizes she's actually not conscious anymore, he stops.
Yes, so he doesn't – he stops. But then what he does – and to me, as for all the flourishes that you have a problem with, for me they worked and they created a character, one that is principled and at least wants to be good for, and is in a sense to a degree trying to redeem himself for everything he did in his past.
Yeah.
And yet at the end of the novel, suddenly he leaves Kelly, who he loves, adores, leaves her there in her own piss and shit, because she's basically let go, on the bed, just leaves her there and then steals all her money and goes and buys this concession trailer, which he's got a thing for because he feels that he can escape Grubb's kitchen.
He can go on the road and cook corn dogs or something, yeah.
Yeah, he's going to make corn dogs. And you think, what the fuck? Look, I get characters make choices that we don't always like, but the effort that Cheryl has put in to build this character is absolutely shot in the face with a shotgun in that bit. Because I just couldn't imagine this Minotaur, the one that he's created, leaving Kelly in her own shit and piss unconscious. He feeds the fish, though. So he feeds her fish, but leaves her in a shit and piss and then takes the money. Yeah. And then when all the people come to his trailer to essentially, you know, say, what the fuck did you do that for? Because everyone's really upset.
Yeah.
And Kelly part defends him as well because they think that he's raped Kelly, but that's not what he's done. It's more that he's just left her there. The book sort of forgives him and she forgives him and what? No, terrible, awful.
This is a problem.
And it's a betrayal of the character. And I'm thinking, why, Stephen Sherrill? Why do you do that? And I know it's your character. Yeah. You can do whatever the fuck you like, but why?
I could actually live with what the Minotaur did. I think he's built enough into the character with the Minotaur's uncertainty about how to act and not knowing really how to interact with people.
Yes, there is a social awkwardness and ineptness to the character.
And I think he's built enough into that where I can see the Minotaur just not knowing what the fuck to do in this situation. I can kind of less buy the leap of taking the money to buy the camper or the concession van, even though the Minotaur's plan is that he and Kelly will go on the road. So he and Kelly will go on the road and they'll have this great life. You know, so it's not like he's just taking the money to buy something for himself. The idea is this is how he will fix this situation. Therefore, Kelly won't have to stay in her crappy little apartment. You know, he won't have to stay in that line cook job. He can do all that.
Cheryl himself in the book says, yeah, but that's not really the case, is it?
Well, the thing is, like, I could just about sort of like, for me, it wasn't a disconnect between the Minotaur that I've seen throughout the book. It was a horrible thing to do, both to leave her there and to take the money. But what I just really objected to the ending, like the actual ending, because as so many reviews and things have pointed out, it is a hopeful ending. And it's like, it's not. It's not there is no way. There is no way Kelly's going on the road because apart from anything else, apart from what he's done, she has her fish who she loves, who literally she says are her babies. One of them dies and we have this scene where she is just inconsolably bereft because one of her
intimacy.
Yeah, right, because one of her there is no way this woman, regardless of how she feels about her shitty apartment, is going on the road with the men. It's just not – it's his dream. It's not hers. And the way –
and they haven't spoken about this either.
No, not at all. And the way the book leaves it is this idea that there's this hope and that Kelly will forgive him and maybe he will be able to do this. And it's like, no, it should have ended with her saying what – I mean, it would have been, I think, quite workable if – with the confrontation and everything and she defended him on the grounds that he didn't actually rape her while she had her fit or after she had her epileptic episode. But it should have just been a case of, like, you've just fucked up again, dude. Give him my money back, maybe we can sit down one day and have a cup of coffee and talk about this. But let me end this right now. I'm not getting in a fucking concession stand with you, and I want my fucking money back. Like that's for Kelly. That's how her character works. And it felt like this was yet another one of these books. And I do hate to say it, but written by a male author who uses a female character as a plot device or as a symbol. So that Kelly becomes, rather than her own self as a person who happens to have epilepsy, and it did rub against me quite a bit, the constant referral to her as also being freakish because she has epilepsy. And therefore that's why her and the Minotaur have a connection, because she also has this freakish thing about her that people don't understand, and that did rub against me. But the idea that this is what she is this personification of this, you know, quote-unquote human freak who the Minotaur can finally connect with because he's found someone like himself, And but she's you know, she's got this life. She's got these goldfish that she loves. She's got and just the idea that you can use her as a character to represent this symbol of hope and this turning point in the Minotaur's life is just, it's gross. I'm sorry, it's really gross. And she just gets completely abandoned as a person in her own right and just used as this, again, this symbol. In this narrative,
I agree with you 100%, but I couldn't buy his actions either because he'd acted honourably throughout the entire novel. Yes, there are hints he's not sure, he's socially inept, he's awkward, but when it came to Kelly in particular, he was always out to protect her. He constantly and look, I don't care who you are, a Minotaur, a Greek beast of Greek mythology, or just a normal person, non-normal, sorry, I don't mean to say it that way, but anyone, an individual, you see someone in that sort of situation where they've had an epileptic fit and he's seen it already. He knows that she suffers this. He's aware of it. And you just leave them?
Yeah. It's quite unforgivable. Like, it's quite unforgivable. So the idea that Kelly...
But I couldn't buy that that's in his character because of what had been built up in the novel.
Yeah.
And yes, I know... You know, I suppose in a sense leaving the dog and not doing anything with a dog partly is a reflection of this. I mean, it might feed into it, but
it absolutely feeds in. Like, this is a character who, like, he is uncomfortable in almost any interaction with a human being, especially
except
if,
for her.
He's uncomfortable with her too. I mean, it starts
initially.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing with Kelly starts because he feels guilty about trying to fit in with those two hideous waiters who are making a joke about her, and he says something, and you know, so like I could get what, like, for me, what he did didn't feel entirely out of character. It felt a little out of character, but it was a fairly extreme circumstance, and he literally didn't know what to do, and this was his very extreme reaction of how to try to fix a problem. Yeah, it didn't come out of left field, but it didn't feel like on a different plane.
Yeah, your issues are completely taking the agency away from Kelly and just simply saying, well,
she can forgive him and that will be hope.
Because Sweeney turns up, the owner of the trailer park, Sweeney turns up, and he's the one who says the wise words.
Yeah.
Well, looks like the you two would be great together in the concession stand.
Right.
And everyone goes, well, that sounds like a good idea.
That's what I mean. So the book validates what the Minotaur's done. And it's like when you think about Kelly and how Kelly has been drawn, and to Cheryl's credit, he's drawn her as you know her as a person, and she's lovely and she works hard and she adores her fucking goldfish. And just to say, have someone else who especially after the situation in which it happened, just decided to make all these decisions on her behalf, which will not fit with her life and will not fit with her dreams and what she wants to do, which we know about. And for the narrative to present her as you know, hopeful and forgiving, and hey, the book ends with us feeling like this might work out for them. And I cannot express how much I hated that, and it has recolored the entire book, and I hate this book now.
Okay, so I don't hate the book, and this is my final word on this because I know we've gone long. I don't hate the book. I still love a good chunk of it. I still love the things that you find annoying about the style. I actually find quite immersive and interesting, and the flourishes, and I enjoy all that. But that ending has soured. I gave it 5 stars on Goodreads when I was younger. I would not give it 5 stars now. So, this is the last time I'm going to use Goodreads as a rating agency, but just because I'd read the book before. So, like, it has coloured my view of the book.
Yeah.
But not to the point where I now hate it.
Because for me, what it does, like, and it's not the first time that the ending of a book has just recoloured a whole book, because once... Like, a book is something that it has been made. This is not a found object, right? So it makes you realise that the author has crafted this book to go to this ending, and so everything he's done along the way has built up to this ending. And so therefore everything he's done with Kelly has been to build up to this ending and so on. And so the whole thing then becomes this, oh, I see what you did now, and I don't like what you did. So
I agree with you, though I do sometimes feel, and you're the writer, I'm the critic, so I do sometimes feel that – some authors don't know how to get out of their own novels. And there was a rushness to that ending too. I mean, literally, it's 15 pages. All the stuff we've just spoken about.
Sure, but you don't...
Is shoehorned at the very end.
I know, but you don't finish a novel and press print on Word. I mean... there's editing and revision
Look, it's probably, if he was here sitting, he'd probably say, no, that's exactly how I wanted to end it. That's exactly what I intended to do. It felt rushed as well, all that. The confrontation at the trailer park, all of that felt rushed to me. Still.
But no. So anyway, there we are.
Okay. So, Kirsten, what are we doing next month?
Okay. So we're going to pick up where we left off, I guess, when we were recording a few years ago, and we're kind of curating our episodes now, usually to a theme or a commonality or something. So this month was obviously books we had read, and now we're doing a reread years later. Next month, what I wanted to look at was two books, which for better or worse, you can describe as literary cli-fi or climate fiction. And they're two books, for those of you who don't know, which you may not, unless you have been listening back in the day, my husband was doing a PhD at about the same time as me, and he was focused on climate fiction. So I was getting these little potted reviews of fiction that he was reading along the way for his work. And there were two that I really, really struck me just from what he'd said about them. And so I thought we could read those two books for the next episode and just talk about this type of approach, I guess, to climate fiction in a way. And they are Flight Behaviour by Barbara Kingsolver and The Overstory by Richard Powers. Now, The Overstory, I know, it's quite a large book. I haven't started on it yet, but I will. But yeah, so they're both climate fiction books, but not in the way that I think genre or science fiction usually tackles climate fiction. So I'm really interested to read them both. They're both, I'm told, quite magnificent books. So I am looking forward to reading them. And you've read one of them, Ian, already.
Yes, I've read The Overstory. I'm not going to reread it.
It's quite a large book.
I'll be honest, because it's very long.
Yes.
I will go through. I look, spoilers, I loved it.
Yes.
But I had issues with it too, which we'll talk about next month.
We will. Okay. Yes, so anyway, so I'm looking forward to reading them both. If you would like to read them along with us before the next episode, which will be in late June at some point, we're going to try to do it monthly just with timetable schedules. It may end up sometimes might be 5 or 6 weeks between episodes, but we're going to try to roughly get one out every month, so we'll see how we go. So you can send feedback by commenting on the website, which is writerandcritic.podbean.com. You can send us an email, which is writerandcritic@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter, where I think Ian is now maybe reconnecting at Writer and Critic. And we have our Patreon page still going. Now, this episode has been published at no cost. We're not charging patrons for this, but I think from the next episode we'll be taking Patreon sponsorship again. So if you are a sponsor, cap your pledge, change your pledge, whatever, these episodes are always free of charge on Patreon or on writerandcritic.podbean.com. It's just that if you would like to throw us a few bucks to keep up with what now will be maybe some technological costs, that would be much appreciated. But you do not have to. But if you're already a patron and you wish to unsubscribe or change your pledge, please do so this month or in the next couple of weeks, because the next episode that goes up in late June, we will likely be making that a sponsored episode again. And I think that's where we're leaving it dreary Saturday morning.
Yes, we will. Okay, thank you very much. It's been great.
It has been. You enjoy your afternoon, Ian.
You too.
Okay, bye. I think we switched it anyway, because you were normally odd and I was even, and last time I introduced it, so that was odd, and now you're even. I'll be odd now. I'm odd now, that, which is perfect. I am odd now. I'm very odd now.
Okay, let's go.